Welcome to The Blue Barrel, a podcast for intelligent conversations about Buddhism, Asian medicine, and embodied spirituality. I'm your host, Dr. Pierce Salguero, a professor of Asian Studies and Health Humanities at Penn State's Abington College outside of Philadelphia. Today, I sit down with Pamela Boyce Sims, a Buddhist practitioner, herbalist, and cultural healer. We talk about how Pamela's Buddhist practice enables her to facilitate self-care sovereignty for impoverished rural and urban communities. We also discuss how she uses deep meditation states to navigate the stark racial and political divides facing contemporary America. Along the way, we talk about the multidimensional nature of reality, plant spirits, and how the 17th Jalwan Karmapa inspired her to get involved in environmental activism. Enjoy, and don't forget to subscribe to Blue Barrel for monthly episodes. Welcome, Pamela. It's great to have you here. Thanks so much for joining us for this podcast. Can you tell our listeners just a brief little bio about what you're currently involved in and what your current passions are?
Thank you so much for having me, Pierce. It's great to be here with you. At the moment, I am bringing to bear a trajectory that has taken me through multiple spiritual traditions, Buddhism being the steady course that has been my guiding light principle framework for most of my life. I'm bringing that to bear on cross-cultural bridging work that is sustained by growing plant medicine all over the country and offering that free of charge in economically distressed communities that are demographically radically different from each other, and in so doing, creating space for cross-cultural conversations.
Yeah, cool. I'm really excited to talk to you about all of this stuff, so let's jump in. Pamela, you have this really rich history of engagement with all kinds of different things like theosophy and neuroscience and Buddhism and all of these different threads. And I'm curious if you can tell us about the Buddhist thread specifically. Like, what's the nature of your Buddhist practice? You spent some time in a monastery, so what kinds of experiences or what kinds of lineages did you engage with? And just kind of paint a picture for our listeners of what the shape of your engagement with Buddhism has been like.
I suppose it is a pretty typical American practitioner introduction to a Buddhist practice. But as a Buddhist practitioner, basically I went looking for some place to practice. And I literally went from monastery to monastery in upstate New York. And I'm a stickler for authenticity and genuine, the real deal kind of thing. And I wanted Tibetan teachers. I really was not interested in American teachers who were at most of the monasteries and teaching centers, et cetera, in that area. So when I found Karmachyana Dharmachakra, when you go up the mountain, when you go up Meads Mountain Road behind Woodstock, and you're circling up and around this mountain, you would not know as you come upon the monastery that you're not looking at something in Tibet. It literally is a complete, beautifully done Tibetan Buddhist monastery. And it is run by Rinpoches and Kempos that I resonated with immediately. So I would commute almost every weekend from Northern Jersey. I'm still a householder at this point, still raising kids in college, et cetera, almost every weekend to practice in that monastery for 2.5 days, to having a space in Woodstock so that I could really immerse myself more in the community, to then leaving householder life behind and living in the monastery. I did Nunez consistently, did the entire purification process, the cleansing process. I did my Nundro. I should mention that Karmachyana Dharmachakra is a Karmakagyu lineage. The head of the lineage is the 17th Jalwan Karmapa. When I was there, the Karmapa, he's a very young man. He is the age of my third child, my daughter. And when he was actually getting his legs as a teacher that was an international teacher, he was under the wing of the Dalai Lama in Dharamsala. I was there during the period where he started coming to Karmatriyana Dharma Chakra. They call it KTD Monastery. And he would do Dharma talks there. He would be there for the week. He would do the 10-day retreats there when I was there. And this Karmapa was the Karmapas embody and catalyze. Their job is to catalyze the times that they're in to stimulate Dharma and the Sangha in whatever time they embody. And this Karmapa was 100% into the stewardship of the environment. He had all of his monasteries in Bhutan and Tibet, all over the world, in Europe, etc., take up this environmental cause. And that's one of the jobs that I had when I was at the monasteries. And I was also very much involved in the Karmapa's environmental movement in the United States.
Great. So but this interest in the environment, was that something that you had been, that you brought with you to the monastery, or was that something that you discovered when you were there?
It's funny. I've come full circle at this point in my life, 50 some odd years later. I began with an understanding of the non-material reality with plant realms, plant energetics through high school. I literally ate up everything Eileen Caddy and Peter Caddy wrote about the founding of Findhorn. I did Eileen Caddy's practices, her meditations as a kid, as a teenager. And because she was so tuned in and I was able to actually work with the realms that she was working with the plant realm energetically, as I was studying herbalism with some of the masters, I was working with William Le Sassier literally the year that he died. He was one of my mentors. But it's only in the last 5 years that I've actually started to grow the medicinal herbs myself. So I've come full circle to the original seed kernel, but it's the first time I've actually put my hands in the dirt and dealt with the plants. Now it's A to Z, soup to nuts. I grow them, know what they do physically in the body, know what they do energetically from a Davic level, from a Findhorn perspective of the overlighting presences that are not visible architects. I know that as well, but I'm also growing them.
Yeah, great. I just wanted to ask you a point of clarification too. For people who aren't familiar with the Findhorn languaging of things, are we talking about plant spirits as distinct entities who you can communicate with and have relations with? Or are we talking about energies?
In Findhorn, Eileen Caddy, Peter Caddy, Dorothy McLean were working with what they were calling devas from Sanskrit. Or Dorothy would talk about angelic presences. But they were also using the word Davic presences. They're working with the actual elementals that are charged with the physical well-being of the plant, as well as the overlighting devas that would work with the plant as a species. And then they're overlighting presences for the gardens. All of this is in the Findhorn material. It's very succinctly and clearly mapped out their part.
Is there anything to say about the role of plant spirits or architects in the current work that you're doing right now? Or is that more from the past?
Climate change, resource depletion, economic contraction. You'd have to be blind not to see it. I, like everybody that was tuned in to what was happening to the energy of Gaia, and a good Buddhist that I am, you serve the most disadvantaged of disadvantaged. In my mind, that was Gaia. That was the earth. So it was crystallized by the fact that the 17th Jawang Karmapa was doing this around the world. And he mandated that every one of his monasteries get involved in environmental work wherever the monastery was located. And the monasteries in Bhutan and Tibet, that you'd see the monks fully robed out there picking up trash and involving in the community and recycling, etc. In my case, I was a trainer at one point for the Transition Environmental Movement out of the UK, a national trainer. So it dovetailed what I was doing in the monastery. I used to have a green monastery program and communicating with all of the KTCs, which are the teaching centers around the country. But in the final analysis, the work as a national trainer actually was what pulled me out of that monastery after 4 years, because they wanted so much of me as a trainer. And that became so compelling. I knew I was compromising my retreat, my Dharma practice in the monastery. And I came out of the monastery and just went full tilt into the environmental movement.
Maybe now is a good time to pivot and talk about the work that you're doing currently. So you said you were involved in cross-cultural work using plants as the medium or the focal point for that work. So tell us a little bit about how exactly that works. How are you actually doing that bridging work?
Is there a short way of putting this? Okay. I did a 2-year fellowship at a Quaker retreat center, and this was in a lovely, affluent area right next to an environmental nightmare of a community, a Black community, Chester, that had been the toxic dumping ground for the entire Mid-Atlantic. It had been strangled politically, economically. Industry had fled out the back door, and people were breathing in oil refinery fumes, trash to steam plant fumes, asthma, COPD, cancer clusters off the chart, right next to this bucolic, beautiful Quaker retreat and a stunning, small, elite college town of Swarthmore, Pennsylvania. So immediately the dissonance hits me as I'm doing this fellowship. And up until that point, to tell you the truth, my entire life had been about spiritual inquiry. And the trajectory was such that focus on racial issues or social dynamics or social justice issues were seen from the framework that did not include direct engagement. So I'm living in this bucolic setting next to this horrible environmental nightmare. And something clicked in me and said, okay, if you're going to bring to bear everything, all of these different spiritual traditions and Buddhism from as the core substrate, it's time to actually pay homage to the fact that you are born with a brown body, this embodiment, and actually focus there and bring that into the equation as well. So what was born out of that was a project that brought into focus a community of practice for cross-cultural bridging between two groups of people, very economically distressed Black communities in southeastern Pennsylvania and poverty-stricken Appalachian communities in central Pennsylvania, many of whom have experienced the exact same disdain from the medical community, who have been mistreated, experimented on, not listened to by the medical community. These two communities, radically different demographics, block two, complementary alternative medicine, herbalism, and natural healing, because they know what chemicals have done to them, what chemical big pharma has done to them, especially in Appalachia, with the level of opioid addiction that we see out there. It manifests differently, but also obviously a problem in Black communities. So that was the impetus. First, I mobilized my networks. I have a vast Quaker network, pretty strong Buddhist network, and a very strong environmental network. I mobilized those networks to find people who would grow medicinal herbs for a plant medicine project. So we have 20 grow sites in 6 different states. We are in Ohio, just outside of Toledo. We are in upstate New York. We are in Vermont. We are in Maryland. We are all across Pennsylvania, and we are in Texas. Those grow sites grow medicinal herbs that are most in demand by people who suffer intergenerational diseases as a function of structural racism and poverty. So we started out with medicinal herbs that treat chronic conditions that big pharma does nothing but medicate you for your life. For example, diabetes, type 2 diabetes, or heart ailments, or obviously high blood pressure, all kinds of PTSD, stress-related illnesses that have to do with the respiratory system that are a function of people for generations breathing in heavily particulate-laden air, because people of color, Black people in particular, were ghettoized in certain areas that were usually less desirable places to live and excluded from other parts of cities. And they ended up in toxic communities because that's where they've been shoved. So the herbs that we grow are directly related to the diseases that are off the chart relative to the mainstream population in the communities that we serve. So that is what these 20 grow sites in these 6 states are growing. All of the medicinal herbs are processed in an apothecary We have a wellness center apothecary where we tincture to produce tinctures and dehydrate to produce teas. And we also have fire ciders. We started with infused oils as well, not essential oils, but infused oils this year as well. So all of those medicinal herbs are sent to the apothecary in southeastern Pennsylvania. The ones that are close enough to us will send us the aerial parts of medicinal herbs, meaning stems, leaves, flowers, seeds, berries, that kind of thing. All the other sites, so that we maintain a pristine product, send us only root crops, ashwagandha, valerian, nettle root, dandelion root, rhodiola up in Vermont, for example. All the root crops, because I don't want them to put leaves in the mail. Even you ship it one day, I can't risk bacteria. Roots can stay a long period of time and they're still fine. So all the sites around the country are sending me root crops. The ones that are close to me are aerial parts, but they're all processed here. That may shift as we get more grounded in Appalachia, but to date, everything is processed in our apothecary here. The organization is governed by a sociocratic process whereby put in your mind's eye an organizational chart that has somebody at the top and a series of larger groups of boxes coming out on the bottom. That's the opposite of what we do. Put a big red X through that in your mind. What we do is basically biomimicry. The entire sociocracy as a governance structure for our network has been adopted to mimic the way cells operate in nature, the completely intertwined, again, here, the whole Buddhist echo in the back of this, completely interdependent, intertwined group of circles, all of which function in an egalitarian way. Decision-making made at the most local node of the fractal and completely through a permeable membrane, the rest of the circles communicate with each other. So that's the governance structure. When you look at our organizational chart, it looks like a bunch of intersecting circles.
Yeah. And so you were saying that you're doing this kind of cultural bridging work. And I'm curious how you mean bridging. Are you actually physically going out into Appalachia and introducing them to these herbs? Or how is the bridging work actually taking place?
So get the image, I think I speak in metaphor a lot, the image of those acts, the circus acts where you have a bunch of plates on rods and you're spinning these different, you're running up and down the rope, spinning these different plates. The first plate we got spinning on that rod was Chester. And whenever you're working in a community that you are not from and you don't sound like that community at all, and the first thing people ask you in Chester is, who are your people? And if your people didn't migrate from South Carolina, North Carolina, which is the population of where Chester hails from, and you haven't been there forever, you're highly suspect until you build trust. So all of the time I was in that, doing that fellowship, and afterwards, I spent all of my time listening to people, aligning with people's sensibilities. It was a big immersion in a culture that was not my culture. Then doing herb education there. And as I began to produce herbs, I was distributing herbs at senior centers, in churches, community organizations, wherever I could find people, getting that first plate spinning in Chester and building trust, deep trust. We did a Live Your Best Life Club. We did all kinds of events, tabling events where we were distributing these herbs. From there, we started adding grow sites. So we now have three grow sites in Chester. We have a grow site in Yardley, a grow site in Media, Pennsylvania. Then moving further out toward the center of Pennsylvania, we have Port Royal, Harrisburg, State College. Several of those are Quaker Friends meetings, actually, on the grow sites on their meeting ground land. So I started working my way over to the Appalachian region by establishing grow sites literally in a line from Chester to central Pennsylvania. And then in this past year, I began the same kind of listening tour, the same kind of trust building in central Pennsylvania that I did in Chester. But this is where there's no way we can divorce and just put on the shelf the work that is being done at internal levels, because I am of African descent. as are several of the people. There's one woman who happens to be of Filipino descent, who are all doing this work with me in central Pennsylvania. Technically, given the beliefs, the social background, the political sensibilities and proclivities in that area, there should be no way any door, any window, any conversation would open up with people who look like me. Yes, I could do the trust building. Yes, I could do the community building. Yes, I could do all of the social justice movement matrix types of things and put all of the movement building models that all of the folks that are doing this from Praxis point of view would put into place. But that's irrelevant when it comes to someone who looks like me walking into those spaces. And yes, I work in Appalachian communities 1 week out of every month. I station myself there and I bring medicinal herbs with me. And I did workshops at the YMCA. I have done workshops at the local yoga studio. I did workshops wherever someone would allow me to do a workshop. I worked with the anti-hunger movement that is out there because people are living in dire economic straits, barely getting by. So the anti-hunger movement was where I started in the YMCA in Phillipsburg. But as I said, those doors should have been shut to me. So it's not a question of some kind of do-gooder movement thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I think a significant number of our listeners are outside of the U.S. and may not have the context for some of the things that we're talking about here. So I want to make sure that we're able to paint a little bit more clearly of a picture of what the communities are like that you're going into and make more explicit what the subtext is behind the comments you were making. So I think I'm going to ask you if you feel comfortable sharing, what is it like for you as a person of African background to go into these Appalachian communities in central Pennsylvania, which are extremely white, extremely poor? This is Trump country. This is a place where people of color are not welcome. And you're entering these communities with your brown body and also with this newfangled herbal products that may be perceived as being coming from outside. I'm wondering what your experience is like entering into those communities and trying to build trust for the project that you're doing.
If you focus your attention on identity politics and egoic constructs of race, class, or the rest of it, then you're missing the whole point of Buddhist practice. So that is not where my attention is focused. And not only is my attention not focused there, but I've learned to navigate a non-material reality that allows me to relate to the Trump supporter in a way that has nothing to do with their outer veneer either. The only way that I'd be able to get in the door. Am I being clear enough there?
Yeah. I'm pushing a little bit because you have this Buddhist background where you are looking past the conventional reality or the egoic structures, as you said, of race and class and gender and so forth. But you're entering into communities in this hyper-polarized, hyper-politicized time in the U.S. right now. And no doubt the people that you're engaging with don't have this sort of Buddhist perspective that they're bringing to the table. You're on the front lines of the current culture war or the current social war, whatever war we're experiencing in the United States. You're on the front lines of that. First of all, as an African-American person. Second of all, as somebody who's doing culture bridging work back and forth with Trump country. And yet you're doing it in a way that seems to be working and seems to be providing healing on both sides of this supposed divide, this supposed battlefront that we supposedly are, you know, cut in half by in this country. And what's informing that healing work across that boundary is your Buddhist practice. Like you said, we're in a period where our time, the planet's time, our time as a society is running out. And there appears to be an urgency that hasn't really been there before. And so I think I want to ask you how you're able to do this kind of bridging work, how you're able to, as an African-American embodied person entering into these Appalachian communities, how are you able to be received in those communities as somebody who has something valuable to share? And how are you able to just walk in and do this kind of healing and bridging that you're talking about?
There are two things I think that are operative when I'm headed out there and when I'm working in central Pennsylvania. The first thing is the level of centering, grounding, preparation that I do, supported by hundreds of practitioners in my networks that hold the space for my connection with people at deep internal levels. And that has nothing to do with wonderful communication skills or nonviolent communication or all of the superb bridging communication processes people go through in trainings. It has to do with spending a great amount of time in a meditative state, an alpha brainwave state, where I am able to connect with people before I meet them or in anticipation of meeting them. And I do so as, again, still point meditation, where I'm recognizing my nirmanakaya, the avatar, the human body, is centered and grounded. In an alpha state, I can relate to them at the level of sambhogkaya, which is myself as consciousness informed by higher dimensions, the dharmakaya. I can deliberately, purposefully, and intentionally direct my attention to people that in whose space I'm going to be and dialogue with them, even though there's no speaking happening, at internal levels. So we get to know each other before I actually head into the room. That has been the case in every interaction that I've had in central Pennsylvania, and it has opened gates, doorways, windows. At this point, I started out working with an anti-hunger program that was feeding 92,000 people during the pandemic at multiple different distribution sites. People would line up cars for miles and miles. And I knew that this was the man that I would need to work with in order to really have the reach that I wanted to have. And he had the connections that I needed deep in these mountain communities. So before I went to see him, I, in a certain sense, knew him because in a meditative state, I was able to make connections with him, and we shared an understanding of our mission, his mission, my mission. So all of the veneer of the personality structure and the enculturation that is part of living in that part of Pennsylvania, it was there, but it was not operative. And I was only relating to that deeper part of himself that was beautiful. It was light. It was uplifting for his people in that Appalachian region. And when I would see the veneer of the deeply conservative way of seeing life emerge, I would shift back to the beauty that was him. And I was, again, able to do this long before I actually met him. I started doing workshops at his YMCA, out of which the hunger program was run. And people started coming to that workshop because they felt so good when they left the workshop. There was just such camaraderie and such sharing at a deep level, which, interestingly enough, for folks out there, they don't share with their neighbors, let alone someone who looks so different from them. Again, my community was holding space for that workshop. I was holding space at inner levels for each workshop. So everyone in that room was surrounded with such compassion that the openness, people were just so forthcoming, and word of mouth started to travel. Long story short, I am now not only doing workshops, but we're establishing what we call self-care circles in several cities in central Pennsylvania as a function of the space that was held, the compassion that was extended, the deep internal communication as consciousness with the original person that then infused all of these other workshops. And I don't use social media to promote anything. They had flyers, hand flyers that they were putting in people's food distribution for the herbal workshops. But the word of mouth just got around.
You've mentioned a couple of times that you have this network or this community that's holding space for that work to happen. So I'm imagining some kind of like remote meditative or energetic support for the work that you're doing. Is that what you're suggesting?
Yes, absolutely. The Community Supported Enlightenment Network is a network of hundreds of people that predominantly the United States, but we're also in Canada, the Caribbean, Indonesia, and India. It started from the original group of people that heard a talk I gave in 2017 that was about engaging in deep contemplative meditative practice and bringing the insights back into our day-to-day lives to infuse movement building. From 2017 to now going into 2024, There are some people that have been in this network for the entire time. Hundreds of people have come in, hundreds of people have come out, but there's always a steady core group of people who are doing this internal work that is done in alpha brainwave states, which an alpha brainwave state is a state you go into when you're doing yoga, for example, or breath work, or still point consciousness meditation, or moving meditation, or sitting meditation. It's a brainwave state. We can intentionally function at frequencies and dimensions that Siddhartha Gautama was talking about when he spoke about Guru Yoga, when he spoke about invoking the five Dhyani Buddhas or the Bodhisattvas. When we do our Nundro, it's invoking the presences of those Bodhisattvas, those masters, the Buddhas, who can offer us expanded awareness, expanded consciousness, expanded perspective that allows us to relate to people at much deeper levels in our day-to-day lives and bring back insights that we can apply to movement building in our day-to-day lives. It's operationalizing what we do on the cushion. That's the community that holds the space.
Yeah, great, great. And operationalizing what we do on the cushion sounds to me like maybe a minor theme in American Buddhism, let's say, maybe particularly among middle-class white American Buddhists, but it seems like the main message about Buddhism in this country seems to revolve around introspection and psychological well-being and stress reduction and so forth.
It's an extremely important Buddhist practice, the kind of introspection and intellectual exploration of texts, the sutras, etc., because it is step one in the exploration of the obscurations that prevent us from exploring our multidimensionality. The challenge is that a lot of American Buddhists get so caught up in the exploration of the obscurations that it becomes an intellectual therapy session at one level and a calming, stilling escape from the craziness in the world at another level. But very rarely is that practice used in service of moving all of the sediment away from the portal that is a doorway, a pathway to a vast understanding of ourselves and the capacity to not just be aware of multidimensionality, but to navigate it. It's a very good step one. What I'm talking about is something quite different. It's literally using that still point consciousness, connection, establishing an awareness. The connection is always there. It's never unbroken between Nirmanakaya and Sambhogakaya, informed by Dharmakaya. Using that not just to be aware and calm ourselves down and be more compassionate, but to actually do what we do when we invoke the Bodhisattvas and listen to the insights and the expanded awareness from these other dimensions and bring that back into movement building. That's very different than social change model matrices.
Yeah, amazing. I wanted to ask you just a quick definition of multidimensionality so people understand what are you using that as a shorthand for.
Multidimensionality is the recognition that the unified, undifferentiated field, the ultimate, evolves in us, through us, as us, by splitting into a web of interconnectedness that operates at multiple frequencies. There is an outbreath of manifestation in all these dimensions are right where we are sitting, right here and now. And we, like a radio, a dial on a radio, we can tune our attention to one or another frequency. And it's easiest to do when our brains are in alpha state. That's when we can turn the dial up and have access to all of this, all of these frequencies with intentionality. And that's why we sit on a cushion.
Great. So I'm going to pivot to just like a more practical question, I guess. I'm curious what you're actually teaching in the herbal workshops. Are you teaching people to grow their own herbs or to use herbs that they acquire from you? Or what's the purpose of the workshop?
Okay. The first round of workshops were related specifically to problems people were having. For example, sleep, circadian rhythms and aligning the body with the earth cycles was one workshop. And I would talk about how to align circadian rhythms with the planet. I would talk about the medicinal herbs that would be calming, medicinal herbs that would assist with sleep. So we would start with a condition people wanted to explore. And then I would build the workshop around that. I did the same thing for type 2 diabetes, for chronic pain, et cetera, et cetera. So that was the first round that people really got excited about. They drove what I spoke about. And I would bring tinctures that I gave away free. We would do an herbal tea tasting so they'd get to taste different teas depending on what the condition was. Sometimes I'd bring some of the superfoods like fenugreek or what have you, et cetera. And at the same time, the initial YMCA that had the anti-hunger program gave us a massive plot on which to have a grow site, a medicinal herb grow site. It was on a farm that the YMCA was connected with. That became our 20th grow site in Appalachia. So not only did the people were hearing about it, depending on the condition that they wanted to talk about, but they knew that that at some point their herbs would also be coming from a grow site that was very nearby. And then when the network and word of mouth started happening, we very recently have begun a pilot project inspired by the barefoot doctors in China, by the Cuban complementary alternative medicine system nationally, by the Costa Rican centering healthcare and having healthcare ambassadors, as well as our theme of self-care sovereignty. People locally taking back command and control of their own self-care. We're now entering a new phase where we're establishing at each one of these original workshop sites what we're calling self-care sovereignty circles, whereby friends, family members, community members, neighbors are coming together in those sites that had been our workshop sites to literally take back their own command and control of their healthcare. So we're now beginning the herbalist training. I'm taking them through system by system, the adaptogens, the anti-inflammatories. They're literally learning to be herbalists. And next summer, they will be able to literally work on that medicinal herb grow site, which is in their backyard in that farm, even as they are becoming community herbalists and then can turnkey complementary alternative medicine to their friends and neighbors in mountain communities from the work that we're doing. The idea is that I do want to mention these are not herbal products coming out of the blue that people are not aware of or familiar with. Whatever community I go into, I make certain I talk to people about the fact that long before Big Pharma, everybody, doesn't matter what culture you're from, had some kind of traditional herbal medicine. If I'm talking to people in Chester, I'm talking about West Africa. But if I'm talking to people in central Pennsylvania, I'm talking about Celtic, Scottish, Irish herbal medicine that people have been on board with forever. And everybody has an auntie or a grandma or a great grandma that they remember went out into the backyard and picked some weed, and they knew that it made their tummy feel better when they were little. So I start there. I always start with the local wisdom, bringing forward in people's minds, in their consciousness, what they've known since for a very long time, centering that, lifting that up, and letting them know that their own tradition has a historical chronology that supports what they're doing now. Actually, in one of the grow sites, I work in an apartment complex of all elders, and we're putting together a little book of home remedies that these elders remember from their grandmas and their great grandmothers. In one of those groups is a 92-year-old woman and a 90-year-old woman. That's how, we're talking about elders, real elders. So you talk about their great grandmas, we're really going back. So we've gone from centering their herbal traditions to workshops about conditions that they're dealing with right now to this next phase is literally herbal training so that they can train people in their community in these self-care sovereignty circles.
Yeah, great. And you were just recently out visiting some of these sites, right? I think just last week, you were out there. Were you in Appalachia?
Yes, yeah.
And how are things going there now?
We're kind of at the inflection point where the work we have, they've officially declared themselves self-care circles. And I've talked to them about what was done in China, how the healthcare outcomes were off of the chart, because it was people from the community that knew the community, that were trusted by the community. The community didn't like the big doctor complex anyway. So we just grounded them in official declaration. We are going to do this for our villages, our towns, our hamlets. And I let people know that the elder complex, for example, the group of elders that are living together in Phillipsburg, in that small town, I'm drawing an arc between that community. I work with a senior center in Chester. At some point, those people are going to be on a Zoom communication with each other. So we're kind of working up. Many of those folks have never been in a room for more than a few seconds, maybe to say hello across the room with a person of color. So when I'm sitting in that space, they're already habituating themselves to realize it's okay. And we're kind of easing the folks in Chester and easing the folks in Appalachia to an understanding. So it's not going to be total culture shock when everybody is on the screen and we're having the conversations, not about politics, but about healing and medicinal herbs and self-care sovereignty circles.
Yeah, that's amazing. So not only about healing in the community, but also healing some of these massive political rifts and racial and cultural divides in the U.S. right now through herbal medicine.
Yes.
That's an amazing story. Yeah. That's tremendously exciting, and I'm really happy to hear about your work, and thank you so much for going into all of this detail about what you're doing. The more you're talking about it, the deeper my appreciation is going for what you're doing. Yeah, this is amazing. I'm wondering, Pamela, if there's anything that we haven't talked about that I should have asked you about, anything that we missed along the way in our conversation.
I do want to lift up the concept of a network, a latticework of self-care sovereignty circles against the backdrop of continual ongoing systems disruption. It's going to be imperative for people who are the most vulnerable, the most marginalized, the last groups of people that people think about when it's time to evacuate, when systems are disrupted. It's important that these communities learn to do for themselves. There is no cavalry coming over the mountain. There is no rescue coming over the hill, as we saw with the people sitting in that stadium during Katrina, or the people who are left out in the cold by systems disruption incessantly. So the self-care sovereignty circles and networks of people doing this for themselves, I think, really is a way forward as climate change dial and systems disruption dial turns up.
This is really tremendously important work that you're doing, Pamela.
Thank you.
How can people support what you're doing? I know you're giving most of this material away. And do you have a nonprofit structure that people can donate to, or can people help spread the word, or how can listeners who want to get involved in this, at least from a distance, supporting what you're doing, how can we do that?
Sure. The distribution arm of the Plant Medicine Project is called Singularity Botanicals, and it's very simply singularitybotanicals.com. If people want to purchase tinctures or purchase teas, that kind of thing, at that website, they'll know that every suggested donation they make for a tincture or a tea is going directly back into the cultivation of medicinal herbs that are given away to distressed communities.
Yeah, great. We'll definitely put all the links in the show notes, and I want to encourage everybody to take a look and see how they can help support this project.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah. Then I guess all that's left to do is to thank you for being here and spending time with us, and really appreciate your work and the stories that you've shared with us for the podcast.
It has been a great conversation. Thank you for your questions.
That's it for today from us at the Blue Barrel Podcast. This episode was hosted by Pierre Salguero and produced and edited by me, Lan Lee. All of our music is by Jonathan Pettit. If you're listening to us on one of our partner podcasts, make sure to catch all of our episodes on pierresalguero.com or subscribe to us on your favorite podcast platform. You can also support us by making a donation at patreon.com/bluebarrel. Until next time, be happy and be well.